Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette today on Wednesday, March the 19th, 2025. Today on the front page of the News Gazette is a beautiful picture of the sun casting a golden glow as it sets Tuesday evening in the country west of Mahomet. And it kind of fills the page with a beautiful golden color and another article at the bottom of the page with the heading Champaign House to Keep Landmark Status. From the University Avenue from Champaign, Jana Wiersema, a local home over a century old is in new hands. The Queen Anne style house at 212 East University Avenue, which is designated as a local landmark and also listed on the Historical Register of Historic Places, has been sold to Abbottville LLC for $125,000, according to the County Recorder's Office. Rebecca Toberette, manager of the LLC, was born in Champaign-Urbana and said she has deep roots in the community. She said she's looking forward to working with the city and the Preservation and Conservation Association of Champaign County to maintain this local landmark, which she is very fond of. I am very interested in historic preservation, and that is actually one of the things that appealed to me about this house. It's that it is intact in mostly its original condition, she said. And I intend to be a good caretaker for this property, she said. The home had previously been owned by Marilyn Wojnar, and after her death in December of 2023, her trust. Her daughter, Debbie Cox, and daughter-in-law, Mary Wojnar, serve as the co-trustees and previously filed an application with the City of Champaign to remove the property's landmark status. Cox told the News Gazette on Tuesday that although the property sold at a reduced price, finding La Tourette was a fairy tale ending to a long process of uncertainty about whether the house could sell as a landmark. Thankfully, I do not have to proceed with my case for landmark removal with the City of Champaign, she said. I know that the Historic Preservation Commission for the City of Champaign may many community members who expressed their appreciation for the home, as well as our family, rejoiced together that the house will remain standing thanks to Rebecca's plans to renovate and restore its distinctive character. And there's a picture of the lovely home, the historic Aaron's Devon Wojnar home at 212 East University Avenue, and it has been designated as a local landmark since 1998. At the top of the front page, there's a small article from the University of Illinois Board of Trustees on agenda, Fee Hike Green Bump College Reorganization. The last U of I Board of Trustees meeting before commencement is set for Thursday in Springfield. Here's editor Jeff D'Alessio with three numbers of note called from the agenda. 2.25%. Excuse me, it starts with $75. The future application fee for prospective undergraduates applying to the university campus, up from the current $50. That figure hasn't changed since 2010, and the move is consistent with application fee practices at peer institutions, U of I officials say. The graduate application fee is also going up from $70 to $90. 2.25%. Modest increase coming Shauna Green's way on June 30th, raising the annual pay of the first coach to lead Illini women's basketball to the postseason in each of her first three seasons from $900,000 to $908,000. Tis the season for coaches cashing in. Beat Xavier or Texas Friday night with Brad Underwood will collect another $25,000. 4. Newly named departments coming to the Carl Illinois College of Medicine. What's now the Department of Clinical Sciences, home to about 600 faculty, will be broken up into four specialty-specific departments: cardiovascular medicine and surgery, surgery and digestive health, neurology and neurosurgery, and oncology. Also on the front page, an article from the Danville School District by Jennifer Bailey, the interim superintendent. Morale is at an all-time high. What started as a whirlwind for Danville interim superintendent John Hart has been downgraded to something a little more manageable. Now, Hart says, it's just a strong breeze. The 10-year assistant superintendent needed to get acclimated quickly to his new role, overseeing a district with 5,000-plus students and around 850 employees, after his former boss was placed on administrative leave last month by the Danville School Board. A separation agreement is in the process of being finalized with Alicia Geddes, who's been working remotely since October due to what the superintendent said were threats to her safety. Her short-term successor is a Westville High School graduate who moved back into his family home after his father died about 7 years ago. Even before beginning his career in education, Hart spent 14 years working in the former Heatcraft Refrigeration Products factory. He said he knew he'd one day end up in District 118. I really don't know why, Hart said. It was just bigger, more diverse, and I loved it. He also knew he wanted to be involved in special education, in part because he roots for the underdog. Sometimes it takes special accommodations, but kids can be whatever they want, said Hart, who student taught at Garfield Elementary with Mary Hardy and Danville High with Jan Mason. On his first day at Danville High, Hart remembers thinking, what have I gotten myself into? But by the time he reported to school the next day, it felt like where he belonged, specifically in special education. He spent his first year teaching in Douglas School in 2001. From there, Hart taught 5 years at Southwest, served as a special education coordinator, then Southwest principal, director of special education, and assistant superintendent. First, over elementary schools, then for the entire district when the other assistant retired. Celebrate the successes. As interim superintendent, the 24-year district employee runs meetings on Mondays when the 8 administrators get together to discuss actionable school improvement plans and which of them will be visiting a school that Thursday. The teachers like to see us, and we like to see the teachers, Hart said. The in-school visits are probably one of my favorite parts of the job, he added. I love working with curriculum and just the direct impact on students, and we've worked really hard to support the teachers. Hart said he hasn't spoken to Geddes since she was placed on leave. Prior to that, when she was working remotely, Hart said he would call her about any issue that arose and keep her in the loop about what was going on in the district. Despite the administrative shakeup, Hart describes the 2024 school year as a productive one. We have our challenges, but we have our successes as well, he said. We're really trying to celebrate the successes and address the challenges, not ignore them, and take more hands-on approach to anything that's going on in the district and really try to address it before it becomes a big problem. Hart said he returns calls to anyone who rings with the goal of getting back within 24 hours. Lately, it's gotten to be a 36-hour turnaround time, but he said he wants parents to continue advocating for their kids and appreciates their correspondence. Among the biggest challenges at the moment is the implementation of the Illinois State Board of Education initiatives around career and technical education, starting with younger grade levels. Another state initiative, limiting cell phone use in schools. This is one the district is ahead of the game on, having already discussed the pros and cons and surveyed parents. An updated policy is under consideration at Danville High, where parents have expressed a desire to be able to reach their students throughout the day. The ban, Hart said, could only apply to classrooms, with students free to use their phones between periods and at other times. I see the distinction, but I can see the positive side as well, Hart said. I see the distraction. As the school year winds down, there's been promising news. Hart said there will be a few retirements after this school year. Hiring has gone well, and the district's buildings are in top shape, especially with the additions to Northeast Elementary Magnet School and Kenneth D. Bailey Academy. Hart is eager to highlight the success stories during his speaking engagement at the high school's graduation in May. I feel like morale is at an all-time high, he said. I really feel like there's motivation to move forward, to really look at what's happening in classrooms and schools, and not necessarily change a lot of things, but with more tweaks and refine. I do feel like there's movement in a positive direction. Kind of torn. Away from work, Hart enjoys true crime books, the outdoors, hiking, visiting parks, and spending quality time with his four awesome grandkids. I love spending time with them, he said. They're involved in archery, soccer, and softball, and they occupy my spare time. Hart and wife Sandy, a nurse at Veterans Affairs, Ileana Healthcare System, have three children, Josh, Alec, and Rain, living close by in Westville and Georgetown. Being an interim superintendent was never part of the long-term career plan, but while he has the job, Hart wants to keep the district steady while looking at ways to improve. Conversations are ongoing regarding adding an assistant superintendent as well as posting the district's top job and starting the search process. There was no time frame put on Hart's interim position. That could come in weeks ahead with a new school board set to be seated following April 1st election. Hart said he hasn't given much thought to whether he'll seek the permanent job. If he were earlier in his career, he said, he might. I don't really know. I'm really kind of torn at this point, he said. I love the job that I have. No decision yet, I guess. In today's paper, there are no articles under community. And so we are going to go to an opinion piece by J. Mark Powell, who has quite a lengthy article today. About America's worst tornado 100 years later. And there is a picture of a tornado-struck area in Murfreesboro, about 10 miles northwest of Carbondale, after the tri-state tornado ripped through the town on March 18th, 1925, killing nearly 700 people. Winter is rarely a bed of roses, and 1925 had been a particularly rough one. A late January blizzard had dumped up to 4 feet of snow in some parts of the Northeast. In Alaska, a diphtheria outbreak threatened the remote town of Nome. The tragedy was averted thanks to 20 sled dog teams that relayed life-saving antitoxin serum through sub-zero temperatures nearly across 675 miles. That journey is commemorated in the annual Iditarod race. In America's midsection, drabness was drawing to a close as winter-weary folks looked forward to spring's arrival. However, a nightmare arrived first. March 18, 1925, began like any other Wednesday in the heartland. It didn't stay normal for long. When the day was over, it had entered the history books. Late winter had been warmer and drier than usual a century ago. Low pressure began moving out of northeast Oklahoma that morning, just as warm air was being pulled up from the Gulf Coast. It was the makings, to borrow a phrase, of a perfect storm. A supercell tornado outbreak was soon roaring through the region, the worst single storm. The tri-state tornado began forming at lunchtime. It touched down in rural southeastern Missouri. An EF5 monster on the modern scale and howled its way north and east. Radio was in its infancy at the time, and there was no warning system. So, the worst tornado in American history and the second worst tornado worldwide moved on, with people in its path unaware of what was racing their way. How bad was it? An 80-foot-tall tipple, which is a structure used to load mined coals into rail cars, was knocked over at Peabody Mine 18. Farmers were killed in their fields. Entire families were swept away by the more than 300-mile-per-hour wind. Debris sucked up... Debris sucked up in Sedgwickville, Missouri, landed 80 miles away. And half the population of Gorham, a town just east of the Mississippi near Shawnee National Forest, died that day. The killer storm broke up Pike County, Indiana, that afternoon. It had covered 219 miles in 3 hours and 45 minutes. Some 695 people were dead, and more than 2,000 others were hurt. Hospitals from St. Louis to Indianapolis were overrun with victims. At least 15,000 homes were leveled. When they tallied up the damage, it came to $16.5 million, more than $3 billion in today's dollars. As bad as the tri-state tornado was, it wasn't the only severe weather that terrible Wednesday. The supercell spawned 8 additional significant storms with damage reported from Kansas to Alabama. Severe thunderstorms, with one producing hail larger than softballs, were reported from Ontario, Canada to West Virginia. When all was said and done, 751 people had lost their lives. Nearly 2,300 more were hurt, all on a single Wednesday afternoon. The cleanup was slow, and the relief was spotty. The Federal Emergency Management Agency was still 54 years away. Some assistance came from volunteer organizations like the American Red Cross, churches, and other charities. However, it was mostly limited to neighbors helping neighbors. In a catastrophe of that scale, there was only so much neighbors could do. Small towns slammed by the twister never recovered, some of them. In Little Griffith, Indiana, for example, not a single structure was untouched, with most of it turned into rubble in a matter of seconds. DeSoto and Murfreesboro in Illinois, and Owensville and Princeton in Indiana likewise suffered extensive damage. There is no known image of the massive twister. People were too busy running for their lives to root cellars and basements to think about grabbing the Kodak or snapping a picture. In this case, a photo of the funnel was unnecessary. Image after image of entire towns transformed into piles of splintered wood was terrifying enough. Time moved on. Those who were able to rebuild did so. There were other disasters that year. Earthquakes rattled Montana and Santa Barbara, California. Another tornado killed 5 and injured 35 in Miami that April. And unusually heavy late autumn snowfall covered the East Coast from Washington to the Great Lakes that day. The day before Halloween, spooking residents there about what could next be coming that winter. The United States experienced other horrific tornadoes in the last century. More than 200 people perished in 1936 when Tupelo, Mississippi was struck. More recently, more than 150 lives were lost and one-third of the city was destroyed when the EF5 storm barreled through Joplin, Missouri in 2011. None have ever come close to the 1925 tri-state tornado outbreak. Meteorologists, first responders, and people living in Tornado Alley pray that that one never will come back again. And there is a picture here of the scene in Murfreesboro, about 10 miles northwest of Carbondale, with everything flattened. So when you hear those sirens, if they go off today, please take cover. Another article from Danville by Jennifer Bailey about the National Junior College Athletic Association security supervisor who doubles as Candyman at the tournament. Brian Castle has two roles this week at the National Junior College Athletic Association Division II Men's Basketball Championship. He's site supervisor with Allied Security at Danville Area Community College. The DACC has its own security, but Allied covers the days the college doesn't have someone. Castle works through the week alongside Nathan Howey, chief of campus security. Castle also is one of the food donors with his business Castle Candies, providing some sweet treats for the players, coaches, and tournament attendees. The hospitality room, in addition to the concessions for the public, features different foods from local restaurants and sponsors. Castle of Fairmont brought more than 80 truffles and candy pieces Monday for the tournament, and they were soon scooped up. They went fast, which is a good sign for how delicious they were. Castle also will be bringing more trays of candy today, Friday, and Saturday. Castle and his wife Amy can be seen at Danville Farmers Markets and other events selling the homemade goodies. Amy helps sometimes set up and sell, but Brian is the candy maker. He started 7 years ago. He uses the cottage food license the state offers to have an at-home business. In the last 3 years, the license changed, so it's been more accommodable for people to succeed with the new laws, he added. Before, he had to get special permits all the time to make and sell his candies. Now a permit lasts the whole year, and he can sell anywhere in Illinois and online. It's really helped businesses like me, he said. He started making candies with his mom, being a cookie maker. She had health problems, and he would just make cookies all the time and give them to people, Castle said. At Christmas time, they would make peanut butter cups, Buckeyes, fudge, and cookies to give them trays of them to people. When she passed, I kind of carried the tradition along, Castle said. A place where he previously worked has been having a small vendor event. He thought he'd try selling some of his homemade candies. He made up 4 or 5 containers and made $100, and then he thought maybe there's something to this, and he could do more with it to supplement his income. He would bring items into work, and he'd try out different recipes. Co-workers and others wanted more. It just kind of spread by word of mouth, and he started going to more vendor events and the Danville Farmers Market. Now he's been with the markets almost 5 years. It was kind of a fun hobby that's gone bigger, he said. Now he has about 40 recipes. He's lost count, some seasonal and some variations in which he makes his candies. He said he's not making tons of money from it, but it's taken a lot more than he anticipated when he started doing it. I thought I would just do some things here and there and stuff, have 10 or 12 things, he said. Now I'm always looking for ideas of ways to expand just a little bit. I don't want to get too broad. Then everyone will want this and this, and I just don't have the time. He makes truffles, cake pops, brownies, candy bars, including homemade versions of Twix, Payday, and a Snickers version with crunchy peanut butter and chocolate-covered pretzels. He rotates them at different markets. Castle makes everything in his kitchen. Last year was the first year he worked at the tournament and brought some items. This year was the first time he was an official food donor, and he's bringing whatever he can donate. He's bringing 4 different flavors of truffles each time he's bringing items in. I thought that'd be enough, that they'd be able to fill in the gaps, but apparently they went over really well, Castle said. Another article from Danville, from the Vermilion County Courts. Danville man gets 15 years for shooting and fleeing incidents. A Danville man was sentenced to 15 years in prison as part of an agreement for him to plead guilty in 2 separate cases from 3 to 4 years ago, one in which another person was shot. Jacob Derrickson, 32, pleaded guilty to aggravated fleeing and attempting to elude a police officer, a Class 4 felony, in 2021, and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. In 2022 case, Derrickson pleaded guilty to aggravated battery with a firearm, a Class X felony, and received a 15-year prison sentence to be served at 85%. The sentences will be served concurrently. Vermilion County Judge Mark S. Goodwin also sentenced Derrickson to 3 years mandatory supervised release. In 2021 case, Danville police officer attempted to stop Derrickson's vehicle on vehicle code violations in the area of Griffin and Seminary Streets, but Derrickson fled, his vehicle reaching 60 miles per hour in a 30-mile zone. The officer lost sight of the vehicle, but it was located moments later, wrecked and abandoned in a ravine at the corner of Colette and Harrison Streets. Police found a prescription medication bottle containing Derrickson's name and later discovered the vehicle had been rented to Derrickson. The following year, police responded to 1800 block of Voorhees Street for a report of shots fired. There they found a male lying in the roadway who had been shot multiple times and 40 caliber casings at the scene. Witnesses say they saw a masked person in dark clothing run up and shoot the victim before fleeing on foot. A person matching the suspect's description was reported in a wooded area several feet from the scene. Officers surrounded the area and Derrickson emerged from the woods. Police located a mask, a .40 caliber handgun, and bag containing identification card for Derrickson in the area where he had been hiding. Forensic testing showed gunshot residue present on Derrickson's hand. Testing completed by the Illinois State Police Forensics Laboratory confirmed Derrickson's DNA was present on the handgun. A press release from Vermilion County State's Attorney Jacqueline Lacey's office did not indicate the extent of the victim's wounds. And a short article from the Champaign County Coroner from Vermilion County, a 35-year-old Indiana man killed in I-74 crash on Tuesday. An Indiana man was killed in a two-vehicle crash shut down westbound lanes on Interstate 74 near the Fithian exit for several hours on Tuesday morning. Champaign County Coroner Lori Brower identified the man as 35-year-old Isaiah Edmond. He was pronounced dead at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana at 5:27 a.m., and an autopsy is scheduled for later this week. Illinois State Police diverted traffic at milepost 200 as they responded to the scene. All lanes reopened around 10:30 a.m. The death is continuing to be investigated by the Coroner's Office State Police. There is a large insert about the NCAA tournament preview that I will be getting to in sports in the second half of the News Gazette, and that has taken up a lot of today's paper. So I'm going to go ahead and read the beginning. Today's history from the daybook section. Area history in 1925, the medical detachment of the 106th Cavalry, comprised of 9 men, left last night for Carbondale to be sent to the southern Illinois district swept by a devastating tornado. The tornado ripped through southern Illinois, eastern Missouri, and southeastern Indiana, killing 1,000 and injuring approximately 2,000. In 1975, the Champaign City Council defeated proposals to extend bar hours and lower the drinking age for hard liquor to 19, but approved sign regulations over 2 years in the making that will ban all billboards in the city and restrict other types of signs. And last, Councilmember Mary Pollock called for the establishment of a joint Champaign-Urbana committee to study the possibility of Campustown seceding from the rest of the Twin Cities. In 2010, Hillcrest beat Centennial 49-42 in a Class 3A state semifinal in Peoria, ending the Chargers' bid for a second straight state championship. Ravonte Rice had 20 points to lead Centennial, which will play Chicago Marshall for the third place. International history today's highlights. On March 19th in 2003, in a televised address, President George W. Bush announced that coalition forces had begun an invasion in Iraq. Bush would declare victory just over 5 weeks later in his Mission Accomplished speech. On this date in 1931, Nevada Governor Fred B. Balzar signed a measure that made the state the first to legalize gambling. And in 1945, during World War II, more than 800 service members were killed when a Japanese dive bomber attacked the carrier USS Franklin near Japan. In 1953, the 25th Academy Awards ceremony was the first to be televised. The Greatest Show on Earth would win the Oscar that year for Best Picture. In 1965, archaeologist E. Lee Spence discovered the wreckage of the SS Georgiana, a Confederate ship that sunk near the Charleston, South Carolina coast exactly 102 years earlier. And in 1966, Texas Western, now the University of Texas at El Paso, became the first team to start 5 black players in the NCAA basketball tournament's championship game. They defeated top-ranked Kentucky in the final, 72-65. And we're going to take a break now. This is the end of the first half of the News Gazette. This is Lisa, and I will bring you the second half after a short break. Thank you.